Well, hello, fellow podcast listener, and welcome to the latest episode of the Pop Culture Pub. Now, for this episode, originally this was going to be a singular episode about the film Bohemian Rhapsody, and we were also going to discuss the band Queen, of which the film Bohemian Rhapsody is about. But there was so much material that I decided to split this into a two-part episode. So the first episode is going to be a Bohemian Rhapsody movie discussion with some Queen discussion. And then part two of this two-part episode will be a Queen discussion with some Bohemian Rhapsody discussion involved. So thank you for listening, and on with the show. Well, we are going to shift the focus from the movie onto the band itself. And I kind of had mentioned a little bit earlier about Nirvana and Queen, and a Nirvana and Queen connection. And there is a couple. One, and again, I apologize if I'm getting any of my facts wrong, because I'm getting my information from the internet. And as we all know, sometimes the internet doesn't tell you the truth. sometimes it's like a bad girlfriend, right? That, you know, that's cheating on you. But anyway, one of the things I had heard was that in Kurt Cobain's suicide note, that he actually wrote about Freddie Mercury in a couple of lines. I don't know how true this is, but this is what I've heard. That he mentions Freddie Mercury in the sense that he expresses his regret that he wasn't as good of a showman as Freddie was, and that he wished he had the ability to work an audience the way Freddie did. Which I thought was very interesting, because that is something that a lot of frontmen, lead singers, and so on will point to Freddie. I mean, it's not just that he had an amazing voice. It's the fact that he could, you know, get the audience to sway their arms. He could get them to repeat things that he was saying. You know, and as they established in the movie, you know, Brian May wrote, "We will rock you," as a way to get the audience involved. You know, and then Radio Gaga, like they do the whole, you know, the clapping thing in the music video that they do in, I mean, you saw it when you watched the Live Aid performance. It is something that, you know, Freddie and Queen as a band, you know, was very good at, was getting the audience involved. So for Cobain to mention that, that does seem like a legitimate thing that he would, you know, maybe be envious of and wish he could do that as well. And then another thing I saw about Nirvana in regards to the Queen. Nirvana, they were at a MTV event. I don't know if it was like a music awards show or a movie awards show or something. I'm not exactly sure, but it was, you know, early 90s, okay? Obviously prior to Kurt Cobain committing suicide, because he was there. But they're, I think it was their bass player on Nirvana. I'm not sure who that is. Apparently, one of the things he does at the end of a performance is he will throw his guitar up in the air, and then he'll catch it.
Oh, yeah. I've seen some people do that before during concerts. It's really cool when they do that.
So anyway, when they were practicing this, like in rehearsals and stuff, there were certain lights that were not turned on, because it was a rehearsal, right? But because Nirvana didn't really do a lot of TV stuff, they weren't used to certain lights being in certain positions and all that kind of thing. So when they were actually doing this on live TV, right, for MTV, when he gets to the part where he throws his guitar up in the air, he looks up to grab it, but there's these lights that they have on for television that weren't there before, and he's blinded by these lights. So you actually see his guitar come down and smash him in the face. And this video I watched on YouTube, actually, you see, like, it smashes him in the face, and then you see him running off stage because he thought he broke his nose. Because it hit, and he could feel the blood coming out, and he knew he was in trouble, right? So he ran backstage. So the other guys didn't really realize what had happened. They just saw their guy run off stage. So then, you know, they kind of realized, uh-oh, something bad happened. So they go backstage looking for their bass player, and they can't find him. Like, he's nowhere to be found. So they go into this room, they open up this room, and he's sitting there drinking champagne with Brian May, the guitarist from Queen. just cool as a cucumber. He's like, you know, and who, I can't remember who was telling the story. It was one of the other members of Nirvana, and he's like, you don't get more rock and roll than that.
Yeah, really.
You know, so yeah, I thought that was a cool connection for Nirvana and Queen. So thoughts on Queen going forward? Apparently, there is a new tour coming this year with Adam Lambert as their lead singer. And what are your thoughts?
Oh, you got to be kidding me!
Yeah, what are your thoughts?
Do you mean
on
they're
that?
Not going to do a reality show?
No.
We need a reality show to find a new lead singer. That's clearly how this has to happen.
Well, this isn't new. Like they have toured with Adam Lambert before. Who, of course,
should I know who that is?
He was one of the runners up, I think, for American Idol. He is a good singer, and I've actually seen him some of his concert stuff on YouTube with Queen, because Brian May and Roger Taylor still tour as Queen. John Deacon, their original bassist, well, not their absolute original, but the guy that was with them for most of their...
For the majority, yeah.
He retired in 1997. And I got to tell you, going off on a quick tangent in regards to John Deacon, I got a lot of respect for John Deacon. He is just a dude that is very down to earth. Like, apparently, he still lives in the same house that he bought in 1975.
Wow.
He's still married to the same woman he married, like, in 1975.
That's a little less impressive, but still really awesome.
But, I mean, for a rock star, you know, like,
yeah,
to be married to
exactly.
the same woman, is that's a big achievement. And
I actually find it a bigger achievement to live in the same house as a rock star for that long.
Yeah.
Than to have the same. That's still incredible, though.
And his, I just saw pictures of him recently at a wedding. I don't know if it was his son or his grandson that got married. I'm not sure. Because John Deacon, I believe, is 67 years old now. And he's actually the youngest member of Queen. I think Freddie was 5 years older than him. So Freddie would be 72 now, I believe, going on 73.
And can you imagine him still touring too? It's, yikes. It's crazy how they can, these rock stars made it through all of those, you know, years of drugs and alcohol and sex and all this stuff. And yet they can still, like, look at Mick Jagger. You know what I mean? The guys and Keith Richards, like, it's insane. They're still touring.
Well, it's like Brian May and Roger Taylor, like they're still touring too. And when you see Brian May, you know, rock a guitar, it's awesome. Like, he is a rock star. But they're in their 70s. It's crazy to think they're that old, but yet still rocking it. And it's awesome. But to be honest with you, I saw a picture of John Deacon not too long ago. He's aged a lot. Like, he really does look like an old man who's retired. And I mean, good on him. I think that's amazing. But there's this quote I found from John Deacon where he's talking about Freddie Mercury. And this was when he was still alive. Freddie is, well, he's my best friend. He's very good for me, you know. I do not like meeting new people, but when I'm with Freddie, I stop being shy. It's amazing how he works on me. And sometimes he's the only one person who understands me. He's my voice, you know. And that was I'm not sure where that quote came from, but that was something that John Deacon said about Freddie. And I know I've read elsewhere that when Freddie died, John basically said, like, as far as he was concerned, like, that was the end of Queen. He had no interest in carrying on with a different lead singer, which I totally get. And he retired in 1997 officially. And when I say he retired, he retired. For the movie, he apparently gave it his blessing, because he's still the Queen is still split four ways. Freddie's share, I think, is divided up between Mary Austin, his ex-girlfriend, and mm-hmm. Jim Beach, the manager, because Jim Beach was the executor of Freddie's will. And then John Deacon, the bass player, Brian May, and Roger Taylor. So apparently, like, in order to do this film, they had to get, like, John's okay to do it, and he did give them his blessing. And from what I've heard, he apparently did watch the film and he really did like it.
Well, it's hard not to.
But
as is obvious by our previous talk.
But when he says he retired, when he said he was going to retire, he did. When they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2001, he didn't even go to the ceremony. Because he said,
wow.
I'm retired. And to me, like, that's the ultimate tribute as a rock star to be inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But for him, like, he is of the opinion, like, hey, when I'm retired, I'm retired. And that's it. So, yeah, like, he lives, living in the same house stuff.
Lifestyle.
Yeah, he lives modestly. Like, he does not, live to excess like you think he would. Mm-hmm. Apparently, he's worth like 105 million pounds. And by pounds, I'm talking about the British dollar.
So it's like 150 million or 170 million Canadian or something like that.
Yeah. And that is prior to the movie. They figure with Bohemian Rhapsody he's going to make a lot more money.
Oh, yeah. And like we said in the previous chat as well, you know, on top of the movie and soundtrack money, he's also going to make more residuals off of everybody streaming and downloading mm-hmm. and buying more older Queen songs.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, the older Queen music, whoever wrote the song gets the residuals for that song.
Oh, so, they don't actually split each... don't split it all four ways, everything?
They do with their later work. Because they actually mentioned that in the movie. Like, when they had their meeting in Jim's office...
Yeah, I remember that.
They said, you
25,
know...
25, 25, 25, 25.
Yeah, everything will be split equally. And that's when... Like, when you look at their later albums, you can really tell the difference. And they mention it in the documentary that when they shared writing credit... You know, they would all work on everything equally and just as passionately, and you can tell by the music. There's really no bad songs. Like, they were all of the same kind of caliber, right? Because they all had a vested interest in it. Whereas prior to that, you know, like, if they wrote a certain song, they would focus on that song because, that you know, like, if it becomes popular, you know, they make more money off it, right? So for John, he actually wrote the number one song by Queen in the United States. So do you know what song that is, Rich?
No.
The number one song that Queen ever did in the United States, the number that chopped or top the charts the longest.
It has to be Bohemian Rhapsody, right?
No.
Or We Are the Champions.
Nope.
Really?
Wow.
This is a John Deacon song, and it was mentioned in the movie prominently, and it is Another One Bites the Dust.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that makes sense, too. Yeah, that would have been one of my top five guesses, for sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's another interesting fact about Queen, is all four members of Queen have composed more than one chart-topping single. They're the only band in the world with every member to be in the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Hmm.
So, like I mentioned, John Deacon, Another One Bites the Dust. He was also co-writer for Under Pressure.
Under Pressure.
And the song I mentioned earlier, Spread Your Wings, one of the best Queen songs ever made. But it's not on the greatest hits, and that was a John Deacon song. Freddie, of course, Bohemian Rhapsody. Killer Queen. We Are the Champions. Love of My Life, of course. Brian May, We Will Rock You. That was his. He's done a number as well. And Roger Taylor, probably his number one most famous one, is Radio Gaga.
Quick question. In the movie, when they go off to that little farm to record, I'm not good with their names as far as remembering which band member is which. Like, I know their names, I just don't remember exactly which one is which when it comes to their instruments and whatnot.
Yep.
But I think it was the drummer was writing a song about his car.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a real song?
It is. I'm in love with my car.
That's a real song?
Oh,
I'm going to have to listen to that afterwards now. I thought it was just a joke for the movie or something, so I never even bothered looking it up or anything.
No, it's a real song. And I got to tell you, like, if you get past the lyrics, it's actually a really good song. Like, it's like one thing that people don't really associate with Queen, but they totally should, is Queen is actually a very metal band. Like, especially a lot of their earlier work and a lot of their later work is very metal. And it really is. Like, if you you got to go back and listen.
I think you're going to have to, like, send me a Spotify playlist here or something.
I have a video that you need to watch. It is called Music Mythos, and it's a series that is done by a guy called The Rageaholic. And what he goes through each individual album that whatever, because Music Mythos and .., you know, whatever band he's talking about, and he does one about Queen. He's a metal guy. So this, you know, like, he normally does a lot of these Music Mythos on metal bands, and he did one on Queen. And he said, like, Queen is a very metal band. A lot of people don't realize this, but it really is, especially their earlier stuff and their later stuff. Some of the, like, they do the March of the Black Queen is a very metal song. Ogre Battle. What can be more metal than a song called Ogre Battle?
True enough.
I honestly can't recommend, like, I think it's a 47-minute long YouTube video where he goes through album by album. Because the thing with Queen is, they touched on this in the movie, like when they did their scene with Mike Myers, and he wanted them to do, keep doing a formulaic style, right? And they said, no, we're not a formulaic band. Like, that's not what we do. We do different music, and Queen really was that. I mean, they did metal. They did rock and roll. Crazy Little Thing Called Love was a tribute to Elvis. They do 80s, what, funk, whatever you want to call it. I mean, Another One Bites the Dust is, you know, something that you would dance to in a club. Radio Gaga is a very, poppy, type of song. Like there's so they do, like they tackle so many different genres. Like it really is amazing. Like there's this one song, I'm not sure of the title. It's on the album. Oh, what was the album? I think it's A Night at the Opera. And it's, you know, like that newfie type of music, you know, like the
Maritimes?
Maritime type of music, you know, with the, you know, where they sing about, you know, a ship and,
yep.
And you know, like people kind of sing along. Brian May does a song on that album that sounds like it was like a maritime song.
Oh, wow.
And it's so good. Like it's amazing. Like there's really no genre, you know, that they didn't kind of tackle in some way in their own way.
Except for like maybe jazz.
Well, they actually did an album called Jazz, but
I was waiting for you to correct me. Though, like actually on the album, blah blah blah.
It's funny on the documentary. It's like one of the U.S. critics, because I mean they kind of never really hit it off with the United States. Like the United States didn't really know how to take Queen, and this one critic was like, you know, why would you call your band Queen when it's got four guys in it? Why would you make a rock album called Jazz when it's not jazz? You know, like, they did things that didn't make sense, but...
To North Americans.
To North Americans. Or to Americans. Yeah. Like it was all right with Canadians, but... But yeah, you know, like, there's definitely a lot of metal in there, like... Brian May is an amazing guitarist and very metal. Like not all the time, but he really can be. We started off, I was talking about Adam Lambert. They're doing a new tour, and it's coming to North America. The closest they're coming to me, where I live, is they're coming to Vancouver. But I can't afford to go. And I'm not a big, like, I don't mind Adam Lambert, but, you know, I don't think I want to spend, you know, thousands of dollars to go to Vancouver to watch this concert.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
You know, like, maybe if it had been Freddie, like, if Freddie was still around, you know, like, maybe I would have done that, but... Not for
I was very close to going to see the Stones again. My father actually got tickets, but he unfortunately got tickets for a city and date that we did not agree on before he bought tickets. So I'm not able to go now, which sucks because that would have been my, I want to say, 8th or maybe 9th time seeing the Rolling Stones live. One or the other. I forget which.
Wow, that would have been cool.
Yeah, for sure. I love seeing the Stones. So, yeah, they're a great live band, as I'm sure seeing Queen would be with, you know, obviously it would be better with, you know, if Freddie was still alive. But, I mean, I'm sure they still put on a pretty damn good show either way.
Oh, yeah, they do.
But like, just like you, like, I would not, like, if they were going to, like, Montreal, maybe, like, I live in Ottawa, so, like, Montreal is a 2-hour drive, you know, Toronto is 6. If they went anywhere other than that, I don't think I would, you know, do it. I would just be like, nope, I'm good.
Well, and the video that I mentioned, the YouTube video called Music Mythos Queen by the Rageaholic, again, everyone check this video out. It's awesome. He goes on
I a actually rant. Just added it to my watch later list.
Excellent. He goes on a rant about Adam Lambert, which is quite hilarious, actually. I think he calls him the karaoke king. And I mean, I don't fault Adam Lambert. Like, he is a good singer. He's no Freddie, but, I mean... I think that's the point, you know, like, I think, you know, as long as Roger Taylor and Brian May, you know, obviously like him and they're touring with him, then I think it's okay. Like, but there is a big difference with Freddie, though, is the fact that Freddie actually wrote songs. And speaking of that, did you know that in 2008, Queen... And by Queen, I'm talking about Brian May and Roger Taylor, did an album with Paul Rogers. Like, no. of all new material. Like, they
really?
Did, yeah, like, the only thing they redid And they didn't even redo it because, you know, when they tour, Paul Rodgers still sings, you know, some of the classic Queen stuff. And Paul Rodgers, you know, he's been a frontman for a number of different bands, you know, Bad Company and a few others. He is an awesome frontman, awesome vocalist, amazing. So when they do concerts, like one song they never did live with Freddie because they wrote, or it was on their last album and he died. The last full album they did with Freddie was a song called "The Show Must Go On." Amazing song, written by Brian May. You know, and the vocals that Freddie does are absolutely amazing. So that was never done live. Like you've never seen, like, Freddie only ever did that song once, and just for the studio album. So Paul Rodgers does it when they did go on tour with him, and he does an amazing job. But yeah, they actually did an album called The Cosmos Rock, which I think was kind of like a play on the fact that I think at the time that's when Brian May was finishing his doctorate in astrophysics. So I think that's why they called it that, because if you look at the album cover, it's the three of them standing there and they're like, and there's like a star field around them. It's actually really cool. I just downloaded it yesterday and I started listening to it, and it's actually very good. Like,
which album? Sorry,
The Cosmos Rock. It's Queen with Paul Rodgers. That's like he doesn't actually join Queen. Like, he's just singing with Queen, and it's an album of all new material that they did back in 2008. Yeah, and it's mentioned in that video that I talked about by the Rageaholic. He talks about it. And he has a lot of great things to say about it because, yeah, Paul Rodgers is an amazing frontman, and Queen is amazing, and it's awesome that they did that. So that was something that that totally passed my radar back in 2008. I totally did not pick up on that.
I love the front of the album says, new studio album features the single Celebrity. It's a great name for a song.
Yeah, and I've watched some of their live performances with Paul Rodgers on YouTube, and yeah, they did quite a good job. So again, continuing the thoughts on Queen going forward, do you think they should do a sequel to Bohemian Rhapsody? I say no.
As like a sequel to the movie?
Sequel to the movie, like where it's like the last.
Oh God, no.
Because there is material there, like, to play devil's advocate, there is material there, like, because there was the 1986, they did a big tour, it's Freddie Mercury's final tour, which goes, it's amazing, like, it's an amazing tour that ended up in, the last show was in Wembley Stadium where Live Aid took place. And then, of course, there, like I said, there was the last few albums that they recorded where, you know, they were all working together and it was, you know, they worked hard and, you know, did some really good music together. But it's also the last few years where Freddie was, you know, deteriorating from the AIDS virus. So there is...
I don't think they could, though, with the fact that they, like, how they sped up the last movie... it would be really weird for them to do another one. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's the thing. Like, unless they change the focus to... I don't know the actor who played Brian May. But if they maybe changed it towards... Maybe instead... Like, this movie was more focused on Freddie, whereas the next movie could be more focused on Brian, because it could be, you know, like the movie deals with...
Gwillem Lee.
Yeah, so the movie deals with Freddie having died and then them still going on, because there's also the tribute.
Okay, yeah.
There's also the tribute concert they did at Wembley, like in 1992, which again, you should check that out on YouTube, where you actually see like Axl Rose and Elton John do Bohemian Rhapsody with Queen.
Oh, wow, that'd be cool.
Minus
Axl Rose.
Honestly, it's the Axl part kind of messed it up, I thought. But anyway. And then they did Somebody to Love with, what's his name? Hunky guy from the 80s who actually just died a few years ago.
David Bowie?
Well, David Bowie does do Under Pressure. At that tribute concert. It's a 3-hour tribute
concert. Hunky guy from the 80s. This is killing me. Now you got to figure that out.
Gotta Have Faith, that guy. Gotta Have Faith, the faith, the faith.
George Michael.
Yeah. Man, his name.
I love that we both thought of that at the same time, too.
His name just totally, it was on the tip of my tongue, and then it just, left. I'm like, what is his name?
Love that song, too. What was the name of his band? Pow? Or Kablamo?
Wham.
Yeah. I knew it was a comic book thing.
Yeah. No, and he does Somebody to Love, and he did an amazing job. Like, that was one of the highlights from that concert. Like, so they could do that as well. And then, of course, they could do, when the band finally came together for the last time in 1997 when they did the song No One But You, Only the Good Die Young. It was a song that they did in... It was a song that initially Brian May had wrote for Freddie and then kind of went on the shelf for a while and they didn't really do anything with it. But then when Princess Di died, they wanted to do a tribute to, people that die young, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they, let's take this song out and let's work it. And then it ultimately became a tribute to Freddie Mercury. That's a video. If you watch it, it's very sad. Like, they did it's such a good song, and it's so sad that, they're singing the song about their friend and how they miss him, and, only the good die young. Like, it's amazing. And it's one, actually, they did a live version during the Paul Rogers, or was it, it was either the Adam Lambert of the Paul Rogers tour that I was watching on YouTube, where Brian and Roger sang it together, and it was very good. But yeah, sequel. I don't think they should do one. But they could. I mean, there's definitely a lot of material there that they could work with.
I don't think it would be nearly as successful though without having a whole lot. Because again, the mass, majority of people. Relate Queen to Freddie Mercury. So if you had another one and half or more of it was about the band after Freddie Mercury, I don't think as many people would care, right? I mean, not to say that it wouldn't be a cool movie, because I mean, the way that you explain it, that would be super cool to see them kind of survive his death and to see what their lives become and how they try to carry on, sort of, kind of, and you know what I mean? Like, that could be very interesting. It could be a great story, but I don't think that the mass majority of people would care as much as with the first film.
Yeah, right? It definitely would be one of those sequels that would not do as well.
Do a straight to DVD release or straight to streaming or something, you know?
I think they could still do a theater release, and I think it would, I think they would still do okay. A
limited release or something?
Well, not even limited. I still think they would do okay with it. Like, I mean, you could still have Rami Malek in it, for part of it. But yeah, again, it definitely wouldn't do as good. And ultimately, I think some people would stay away because knowing the subject material, because it is very sad. It's a very sad thing that happened to Freddie.
Yeah.
And kind of going off a bit of a tangent here in regards to HIV and AIDS. I think some people who weren't alive in the 80s may not realize just how dire things were back then, and as far as that disease went. People just didn't know. Like science didn't really understand what was going on at the time. It was very early stages, right? Like now, if someone, like Charlie Sheen, for example, he came out a few years ago that he was, he's HIV positive. Charlie Sheen could, assuming he doesn't die from drugs or whatever, he could live to be a very old man and just die of natural causes. Because now they have drugs that Like, they don't have a cure for HIV, but they have drugs that keep HIV from destroying your immune system, which is what it does. Like, it's a virus that attacks your immune system, and then ultimately when your immune system is gone and it's destroyed, that's when you have AIDS. That's when, you know, you have, there's no, your body cannot defend itself anymore. So Freddie Mercury actually died from, I think it was a bronchial pneumonia, I believe is what he died from. So, you know, using the air quotes, AIDS, you know, HIV eliminates your immune system. AIDS is what happens when you don't have your immune system, and then you're susceptible to bronchial pneumonia. Whereas if he had an immune system, he would probably be alive. And unfortunately, back then, they didn't really know stuff. They didn't have the drugs that they have now. So back then, like, when you found out you were HIV positive, it was a death sentence. Like, it was terrible. It was a terrible thing to be diagnosed with. It's a terrible thing to live with.
Yeah. You know, and it still is, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. But, like, nowadays, like, I mean,
it's not as big of a death sentence.
It's not an epidemic in where we are. Like it was back in the 80s. Because it really was, because people didn't understand what was causing it. I mean, it really, you know, hit a certain demographic.
Condoms weren't as big a thing back then either, right? Like, people weren't using condoms as much back in the 70s and 80s the 90s, right? So,
well, and that's the thing. Like, that's why it really hit the gay community a lot harder than anyone else, because, you know, people were heterosexual people were protecting themselves against this virus without even realizing they were protecting themselves because
they were trying to not have kids.
Yes. They didn't want to get the girl pregnant. So that's why they wore condoms. Whereas two guys, why would you bother wearing condoms when no one's getting pregnant?
It just takes the pleasure away.
Yeah. Like,
quote unquote.
So, you know, so that's why it really hit the gay community really hard in the 80s and 70s. And they didn't understand, like, why this virus was doing this. And it's crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, nowadays, like I said, like, they've got, you know, in first world countries, you know, they have drugs that you can take. As long as you're taking these drugs, it'll keep HIV, basically it blocks HIV from destroying your immune system. It doesn't cure it. It just blocks it. So as long as you keep taking your pills, you know, you should live along and happy life, you know, other than, unfortunately, you have this virus in your body that will never go away. Which is why, like, in Africa, it's still an epidemic, because they don't have medicine. Like, they don't have, you know, it's a third world country there. Third world environment. So they don't have the same access that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a death sentence anymore. And it's really sad, because with Freddie Mercury, had he contracted the virus a few years later than he had, he'd probably still be alive today. You know, take for example, Magic Johnson. You know, like, I remember, you know, it was like the early 90s, like, I want to say like 92, 93, maybe even earlier than that, when Magic Johnson, you know, was diagnosed with HIV. And back then, you just assumed, well, he'll be dead in a few years, you know. Because back then it was a death sentence, but he's still alive today because, you know, science and medicine have come along so far that it's not a death sentence anymore.
91-92 season, by the way. After a physical before the 91-92 NBA season, Johnson discovered that he had tested positive for HIV. In a press conference held on November 7th, 1991, Johnson made a public announcement that he would retire immediately.
Yeah, because, again, so, like, back then they really didn't fully understand, you know, like, because their biggest fear was that, well, what if he cuts himself on the court? Like, what if he, you know, and they bleeds on somebody? Like, are they gonna, you know, like, and so he was basically forced to retire. Like, nowadays we understand things a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. But, well, and it's very similar. I mean, like, it's in a certain way. I mean, I kind of feel bad that I'm going to compare it, but I mean, like, in a way, it's similar to Hep C as well, at least in sports and stuff like that, right? Because it's another disease that is or can be life-altering, you know, in a very negative way. It can have very, very detrimental health effects, and it can be transferred through contact with bodily fluids. I forget exactly which ones, you know what I mean, and how much and where it has to happen. And I don't know specifics about that, but I know that it can be. And so there are a lot of people who have also had to retire from sports due to Hep C. In fact, there's a very good documentary about a wrestler who had to retire a few years ago due to contracting Hep C. And he was like literally like just about to kind of become a big thing. Like I think he was about to head over to WWE, and he was doing one of his last shows or something like that in a smaller promotion or something, and then he discovered that he had HIV and Hep C, and they immediately forced him to retire. And there's a documentary about this following him, because I guess they were doing a documentary about him, I think, before they knew, and then it just kind of turned into the downfall of him sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's sad how things like this can have such a detrimental effect to people's careers as well as their own personal lives and their health as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And an interesting thing, like I was saying about HIV, is like the research that's been done and the things that they've discovered. It's absolutely amazing that they've actually figured out where it started. It actually started as a virus in monkeys, and it jumped species to humans. And they figured out sometime in the early 1900s in Africa. And they actually have an area of Africa that they figured it stayed in for decades, because that, you know, area of, I think it was in the Congo, those people just didn't interact with the outside world, so it never spread until I think it was like the 1950s or something. They figure it started migrating to Europe, and then eventually it came to North America, I believe they said in the 50s or 60s. Like, it's to me, it's just amazing how far that they've come, that they know all this stuff now, that they're able to figure out where it originated from, when it migrated to North America, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's truly amazing how far we've come, and I really do think one day they will find a cure. It's just a matter of time.
Or at least be able to control it even more so than they do now, at a very minimum, for sure.
Yeah, like where, you know, if you get it, you know, you get one injection and then you're good. You know, it'd be like, you know, when you get your tetanus shot or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
One day it will get to that. But anyway, getting back to talking about the band a little bit. Again, a documentary to check out, Queen Days of Our Lives. Great documentary. It's made with Queen, includes interviews with the band. It's in Canada, it's available on the Crave TV app, if you have that. I know in the UK, it first aired on ITV, I believe. And I know it is available for sale on Amazon. So it is out there, and it is worth it. A lot of the special features. Actually, you could technically watch it on YouTube if you want. The only problem is the version they have on YouTube has subtitles from a different language. I want to say it's Dutch. they have Dutch subtitles, I'm pretty sure.
Well, it's time to check Daily Motion and Vimeo then.
So yeah, as I said, after following this, I'm listening to all their albums, because as I had mentioned, the Greatest Hits CDs, there's three of them. It's a three-disc collection. There's really so much good songs that are not on those CDs. And so you really have to check out the albums themselves. Like, most recently, I picked up, and by pick up, I mean I'm downloading them from iTunes. And they're very, very cheap on iTunes. Like, most of these albums are only like $9.99, I think. The one I just picked up was The Miracle, and it was their second last album before Freddie died. Because their last album before Freddie died was Innuendo. So The Miracle, I think, was just before that. There's a song called Was It All Worth It? And that is an awesome song, and it is not on their greatest hits. And basically it's them singing about, you know, was everything that they've done so far, was it all worth it? And yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. Spread Your Wings, like I said, great song. Definitely check those out. Because like I said, like getting back to talking about the Tragically Hip, one of my favorite songs from the Tragically Hip is a song called Every Time You Go. Or no, Everywhere You Go. Yeah, that's what it is. Not Every Time You Go. Everywhere You Go. It was on their Up to Here album, which I think is their third album, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe it was their second. Anyway, that is my all-time favorite Hip song. And it is not on any of their greatest hit CDs. It is not on their any of their live albums. But to me, it's their most fantastic song. But the thing is, like I said, like I listened to the Hip album by album going forward as they were being released. So I developed appreciation for a lot of the songs that aren't considered their greatest hits.
And they probably also remind you of a certain time in your life that you have a connection with, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there is that too. But like with, like I said, but with Queen, there's so many good songs that just aren't, you know, basically in the public consciousness, and it's, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out album by album. There's definitely some gems in there. And yeah, they really did do the rock star thing. Like, they had fun, they partied, they really were urban legends. There are a lot of things that they did. So I have some interesting facts here about Queen. Freddie Mercury and his sister created a fantasy world called Rye. Apparently they did this when they created this fantasy world when they were kids. Huh. So this world was used in Queen songs, such as the song Seven Seas of Rye, Ogre Battle, which I mentioned earlier, March of the Black Queen. And one of the things I found interesting was when I Googled Ogre Battle, there's a video game called Ogre Battle, March of the Black Queen for the PlayStation and the Sega Saturn. Apparently this is a game series, Ogre Battle. And I find it a strange coincidence that Queen did a song called Ogre Battle and also did a song called March of the Black Queen back in the early 70s.
And it's then, also a SNES game as well.
Yeah, and then these video games come out started coming out in the mid-90s, I want to say. So I don't know.
Yeah, 93 in Japan and 95 in North America. It's the first was the first installment in the series. And it looks really cool, actually. It looks like an RPG, which I would totally be into, so I might actually have to play that. Thank you.
Yeah, so like I said, I had not heard about this before. I don't know if it's in any way tied to Queen. I don't know if Queen actually knows what. I'm assuming they must at this point, but
cool.
Also,
that is
one of the things I noticed when I was watching the Days of Our Lives documentary, and we're talking about, you know, rock and roll here, Harrison Ford. There's this one scene where they are doing a concert in L.A. or it was either they were doing a concert or they were recording one of their albums in L.A. And there's a scene where you see Harrison Ford, like this is like 1977, 78. This is like when he was doing Star Wars, the original Star Wars.
Okay.
Backstage knocking over an ice sculpture. Like, you see him run up to this ice sculpture and, like, knock it over and smash, and it gets smashed on the floor. And I have no idea what the story is behind that. They just show Harrison Ford going, either that or it's some guy that looks exactly like Harrison Ford from the original Star Wars. And he runs up, like he's walking with the band, and then he runs up to this ice sculpture and knocks it on the floor. So I don't know what the story is. I want to know. I think that's fascinating.
On purpose or by accident?
Oh, yeah. He's definitely running up and knocking it over on purpose.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know what's going on there, but I want to know.
That's really funny.
I think that's amazing. So there's a Star Wars connection. And, of course, there's the line in, what's that? Bicycle Race, where he says, and I don't like Star Wars. Apparently that's not true. Apparently Freddie Mercury really liked Star Wars, and there's actually a concert, I can't remember if it's the one in Montreal or where it was exactly, where he actually comes on stage where Darth Vader's giving him a piggyback.
Oh.
So, yeah, he walks on stage on the shoulders of Darth Vader. Freddie Mercury does, so. He actually did like Star Wars. One of the things I've learned is, and I find this fascinating with any band, when I find this out about a band, just how multi-talented their members all were. Like, Queen, without a doubt, is one of the most multi-talented bands ever. Freddie, Brian, and John could all play the piano. So a lot of the songs, like, you saw in Live Aid when Freddie was playing the piano. Also, Brian plays the piano, like in the song that I was talking about that they did in tribute to Freddie Mercury and Princess Di, No One But You, Only the Good Die Young. Brian May is on the piano for part of that music video. He's actually playing the piano. And then the other song that I like, the Spread Your Wings song, like when you watch that video, again, it's a John Deacon song. It begins with a piano. And it's actually John Deacon playing the piano. And then as it turns into the song, you actually see John playing the piano. And then he stands up because he's got his bass guitar sitting on his lap. And then he just jumps into playing the guitar. And I just think that's so awesome and like true rock and roll when you go when you can go from playing the piano to playing a guitar, you know, and just like that.
Oh, for sure.
So I thought that was fascinating. Brian and Roger are, as of course Freddie Mercury, are gifted singers in their own right. Like I said, Roger, there's some songs that Roger actually sings in some of these different albums, and one of them was I'm in Love with My Car, which is actually a pretty cool song. Like, it's kind of the butt of jokes in the film, but it's actually a, kind of a cool sounding song, and Roger does sing it. And there are other songs too, and also, like I said, Brian also sings. For example, Only the Good Die Young, both Brian and Roger sing verses of that song. After they did their final album, Innuendo, Freddie knew he was dying. He knew he only had, you know, a short time to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what kept him going was making music, and he was really enjoying it. So he just told the guys, he's like, okay, you know, like, give me stuff to sing. You know, just write stuff down. You know, if you have, you know, as you're writing it, you know, I'll come in. I'll sing it, and then you guys can do. You know, when I'm gone, you guys can do what you want with it. So he actually, their album they did after Innuendo is an album called Made in Heaven. And it's actually made up mostly of music that Freddie sang, knowing that he would never live to actually hear it.
Oh, wow.
So Yeah, so what they would do is, like, they would kind of, you know, come up with stuff to, for him to sing. And then he would sing it in three different ways. Like, he would do, like, three different takes on it, and then they would move on. So that would give them three different options to play with when they would go and edit it later, right?
Oh, wow.
So in that album, there's a song called Mother Love, which Freddie sang the first two verses for. And it and he does an amazing job. Like the range that he exudes in that song is absolutely amazing. And then after the second verse, there's kind of like, and it's mentioned again in that Rageaholic video that I mentioned. And he actually gets kind of emotional when he talks about this. There's this long pause. It's almost, and the way he described it was actually quite good. He's like, you know, when you go to a concert and the lead singer's microphone's not working and the rest of the band just keeps playing until they can get it figured out.
Yeah.
He's like, that's kind of what happens after the second verse. You know, it just kind of goes on a little bit longer than you think it would, like the music part. And mm-hmm. then it, and then the music, then the singing starts again, but it's not Freddie singing now. It's Brian May singing.
Oh.
Because what had happened was they were doing this, and then Freddie did the second verse and stuff, and he's like, okay, guys, I'm really tired. You know, I just need to go rest, and I'll come back and I'll finish this. And, but he never did. Like, he ended up getting really sick, and he died, you know, a few weeks later.
Yikes.
So it was quite sad, but, and when you listen to that song, it's even all the more powerful, you know, especially when you consider, like, the range that
Freddie... I really enjoy it when stuff like that happens, like when somebody gets partway through filming a movie and they die, and then, you know, a bunch of different people come together and help complete it. Like, what was the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, I think it was?
Yeah.
Heath Ledger died during the filming of it, and, like, three or four different actors, was Jude Law,
Kate Blanchett.
Yeah, like a bunch of different people basically came in and helped finish it. I mean, like, the movie is all sorts of a clusterfuck, but it's really touching that they all did that, and it makes it very interesting. You know what I mean? That's just one example of a movie where that happened, but there's many examples of TV shows, movies, music, and so on and so forth that happens. And it's always really great when people come together and decide to complete projects that, you know, whoever was working on it was passionate about and just didn't get a chance to finish, right?
Yeah, and it's very interesting. Yeah, this part was very interesting because, like, Freddie knew he was dying, right? Like, so he knew that he would never hear this. So there was that part of it that was interesting. But also the fact that, you know, like, because after he died, Brian and them kind of, like, they were grieving. And they, you know, they stepped away and did their own things and didn't really want to go back to it. So it was years later that they actually went back and did the Made in Heaven album, which was released in 1995. So it was 4 years after their last album was released and 4 years after Freddie died. And they said it was so surreal to be making this music with Freddie not there. Like, Freddie was just mm-hmm. a voice coming out of the speaker.
Oh, like, I'm sure that must have been heart-wrenching, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. And you know, Rageaholic kind of talks about it a little bit, that Made in Heaven's kind of a mishmash. You know, it's... You know, like, because when they were writing this stuff and giving it to him to sing, they weren't exactly sure, you know, what the song was going to be, how, you know, what the instrumentation was going to be, because, you know, basically he just had, like, a, you know, like, what do you call that? Like, that's, you know, when they shake, like, it's almost like a beanbag thing, you know, when they shake it to get the beat going for the music.
Tambourine?
No, it's oh, what do they call that? It's they got, like, it's like a beanbag where it's got the ends, but, like, the middle's like a grippy thing.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm not a musician, so I'm really bad at this.
It's when you need to text Sebastian.
Yeah, but you shake it, you know, and it makes kind of like the beat. You know, it's like a.
I know of a metronome to help keep the beat and the time, but that's about it.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called, but you hear it in some of their songs, because that's all that Freddie's going by, right? And you actually hear, they actually keep it in some of the songs that they do for this album. So it was very, very interesting experience that they did. And like I said, Mother Love is a very powerful song. And it's even more so when you realize that that was the last thing Freddie did. But speaking of amazing songs, I mentioned it before, earlier. It's the song, The Show Must Go On. Mm-hmm. And it's a song that Brian May basically wrote for Freddie, basically because Freddie's talking about, you know, without coming right out and saying it, his struggles, you know, like what he's going through, and that the show must go on.
Mm-hmm.
And the legend behind the song, like, have you ever heard the song before?
I might have. I don't think so. I might have. I'd probably have to hear it again to be able to know for sure, though.
Okay. The Show Must Go On by Queen. Check that out on YouTube. The music video. It's a very, because again, like, Freddie was so sick that they couldn't actually do a music video with him in it. So basically, that music video was just like clips from some of their live performances. It's clips from other music videos that they used, and it's, you know, kind of like a collage of different stuff they did in the mid to late 80s
and early
90s. The legend behind this, and to me, this is my favorite Queen song, by the way. The Show Must Go On. It is it's my favorite. Freddie's voice is so powerful in this song, it's hard to believe that he was dying. It's hard to believe that, you know, he was, you know, going through such tough health issues. You know, you would never know by his voice, because it's so powerful in this song. But the legend behind it is that he did it in one take.
Wow.
I don't know if that, like, I've heard two different versions. Rageaholic says he does it in one take. And I mean, that when you watch that video that he does, the musical mythos or whatever, or metal mythos, or what did I call it?
Music mythos. Yep.
He does his research. So if he says it's one take, it's one take. But I've also heard that it was one session. But either way, if it's done in an afternoon or if it's done in one take, it's still amazing.
Yeah, it's still intense.
Yeah, like the fact that he pulls it off and does it so well. And like I said, like, this song was never done live. He only did it this one time. So, you know, I don't know how it would have sounded live. But Elton John did this song at the tribute concert. He's saying The Show Must Go On. And also Paul Rogers sings it. And they're both great singers. You know, Elton John's an amazing singer, and Paul Rogers is amazing. But neither of them could match what Freddie did with this song. And they say that Freddie, like, again, I'm not a music guy, so as far as making music, I don't know what 4 octaves mean, but apparently he was able to reach 4 octaves as a singer, which I'm told is very impressive. Like that's like almost like opera. Like, his, I mean, he did do some opera, like Freddie Mercury did that song Barcelona with that famous Spanish opera singer. I can't remember what her name was.
Okay.
But apparently, like, his like, he had like an operatic voice, like he could sing that high, right? And he could also sing very low. which most singers cannot do. And when you hear Elton John and Paul Rogers sing The Show Must Go On, they do a good job, but it don't even come close to being as good as Freddie did. And when you do it on stage, you're doing it one take, right? You can't stop. You have to keep going. You have to do it that one time because it's live, because you've got thousands of people out there watching you do it. You can't cut it up. So them doing it live is really no different than what Freddie did in the studio if he really did do it in one take. So to me, that is evidence of just how amazing Freddie was as a singer, as a vocalist. But yeah, definitely check out that music video. It's absolutely fantastic. What else was I going to... So The Show Must Go On. Some of the other ones. Don't Stop Me Now, which was the one that... It was in the credits. That's when you saw Freddie, you know, the video that you saw in the credits for Bohemian Rhapsody.
That's great. A great freaking song.
Yeah, great song. Of course, I mentioned the John Deacon songs. Another One Bites the Dust, Spread Your Wings, Under Pressure. Amazing, all of them. Just looking at some of my other notes here. I talked about how multi-talented they all were. I talked about the fantasy. Oh, did you, and I know I've seen this before, but I really didn't look too much into it. Did you know that there is a Queen musical?
No.
It's called We Will Rock You.
And go figure.
And apparently it's been around since like 2002. So I got a little information here. We Will Rock You is a rock musical based on the songs of the British rock band Queen. The music tells the story of a group of bohemians who struggle to restore the free exchange of thought, fashion, and live music in a distant future where everyone dresses, thinks, and acts the same.
Does it take place in the land of Rye?
It might. Musical instruments and composers are forbidden, and rock music is all but unknown. And it's by playwright Ben Elton. And these are some of the characters. Characters include Khashoggi, Galileo Figaro, Meat, Scaramouche, Pop, Brit, and Killer Queen. And again, this began production in the UK and the West End in 2002, and they just announced a 2019 UK tour. Apparently, they spent a year in Vegas in 2004. They did do a 2013 North America tour, which was comprised mainly of U.S. cities, but they did hit Thunder Bay November 26th and 27th, 2013, and they also played...
Thunder Bay, Ontario?
Yep, and they also played Toronto from April 29th to May 10th, 2014.
Can't believe they would go to Thunder Bay and not fucking Ottawa.
I know. I found that weird.
Dicks.
I thought that was weird too. But
even like not even Montreal, like really, like Thunder Bay, Thunder fucking Bay.
Well, yeah, and
weird choice.
Yeah,
somebody on the production team must have a family member or something there.
Yeah. Well, they were only there for 2 days too. So to me, that seems like a lot. You know, that
long way to go for 2 days.
Yeah, for 2 days. But like you said, maybe that playwright's from Thunder Bay. I don't know. But yeah, it's weird that they wouldn't play Montreal because Montreal was one of their most famous concerts. There's actually a filmed Queen concert from 1981, where it was done in Montreal. So I don't know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's just called Queen Rocks Montreal. It's it is available on DVD. I've watched certain videos from that concert on YouTube. They do Another One Bites the Dust. I think that is probably the best version I've ever heard of Another One Bites
the Dust. Oh, wow.
Because in that version, Roger Taylor, who's the drummer, he does the backup vocals for Another One Bites the Dust. So he's actually singing with Freddie for that song. And it sounds amazing because, like I said, Roger and Brian were both amazing vocalists and are amazing vocalists. They still sing. But yeah. Hearing him and Freddie sing Another One Bites the Dust together was really cool.
Hmm.
And John Deacon, when they would do the group singing, they showed them in the movie when they did the Bohemian Rhapsody, when they're all in the booth together and then they knock over the soundproofing boards and stuff. John Deacon would sing in those group settings, but he would never sing individually. He would never sing a song, because he said I'm not a vocalist. That's not my thing. But like I said, he was multi-talented in other ways. I mean, he was an amazing songwriter, and he could play the piano as well as the bass guitar. But anyway, getting back to We Will Rock You, I just thought that was such a neat concept. You can't get more science fiction than that. Having it take place in a distant future and whatnot.
I thought you meant the actual song We Will Rock You, and I was like, huh? Science fiction? What are you talking about?
No.
Lost me there for a second.
No, the stage show.
Yes.
And then also another. You probably saw that I posted this today. Montreux. It's. I've mentioned it before. Is where they recorded a lot of their later albums and stuff. Because again, getting back to the. One thing that we don't really, we kind of get it here a little bit, but not as much. But in the UK, the tabloids are way worse than they are here.
My mom gets some of the tabloids. She has a subscription to a few of them. It's hilarious.
Yeah, I know. My mom used to do that too. But the back in those days, they were hounding Freddie Mercury because Freddie never publicly admitted he had AIDS until the day before he died. That's when he finally issued a statement. But everyone knew he was sick because he lost a lot of weight. He was, rarely seen in public. Queen did not tour the last, 5 years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He was very reclusive. So he, like they said in the documentary, he would go to Freddie's house and there'd be 200 paparazzi hanging outside his mansion trying to take pictures of him. So what they did was they went to Montreux in Switzerland to record there the last couple albums that they did, and then also the music that they did for the Made in Heaven album, just because the paparazzi, in Switzerland, they didn't give a shit. They're they paparazzi do not run things in Switzerland the way they do in the UK.
Well, didn't they have to change some of the laws around paparazzi after they killed Di, basically?
Yeah. But that's the thing. Princess Di was 6 years after Freddie died. So, he couldn't go out for groceries without being hounded, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
imagine if they had TMZ back then. Good lord.
Yeah. Well, I mean that they the British paparazzi were really the founding fathers of TMZ.
Oh yeah. Oh for sure.
And all of them now. Another interesting fact. I didn't actually have this written down, but it made me think about it. When Freddie died, he got cremated, and his ashes were given to Mary Austin because he even though he was dating Jim Hutton when he died, and he had been with Jim Hutton for 7 years, I think, and they lived together and stuff, but he always said that Mary was the love of his life. That was the one.
Yeah.
He always maintained that he was bisexual, even though people said he was gay, and Mary said he was gay. He maintained that he was bisexual, and he actually did have other relationships with other women, too. But that, of course, that's not interesting, right? That wasn't the focus of the paparazzi. They didn't care about the women he was with. They wanted to know the men he was with, because that was, you know, taboo, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Back in the 80s. Excuse me. So anyway, when he died, like I'd mentioned, he left his, you know, the bulk of his estate to Mary Austin. So she's, you know, I think they said they figure she's going to make like $40 million from Bohemian Rhapsody.
I wonder if Jim Hutton is getting any money from it.
No. Well, Jim Hutton,
like, actually, from his estate or like anything.
Well, Jim Hutton actually passed away in 2011. I think.
Oh, okay. Well, he's definitely not getting anything then.
Yeah, he died of cancer. I think he was HIV positive as well. But he actually died of cancer, I believe. I want to say 2011.
But I mean, like, just in general, I wonder how much of the estate was left to him as well, because I'm sure Freddie wouldn't have left him with nothing if he was also one of the loves of his life.
Well, to be honest with you, from what I understand, I believe he only left Jim Hutton $500,000. From what I understand, he left him $500,000. He left other people stuff, but the bulk of his estate went to Mary, and actually his mansion went to Mary as well. So I don't know what happened between Mary and Jim, but all I know is that after Freddie died, Mary kicked Jim out, and he actually moved back to, I want to say Ireland. I think he's from Ireland. He actually moved back to Ireland, and he kind of just did his own thing. Like, I know he wrote a book called Mercury and Me, and it was about his relationship with Freddie Mercury, and I'm told it's a very good book. I'm told, because apparently there's a lot of books out there that are written by people who didn't really know Freddie or were just basically going by the tabloids and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of misinformation out there, but I'm told that Jim Hutton's book is very good. Like, it's very truthful. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what happened between him and Mary, but yeah, I guess Freddie only left him like $500,000, and then Mary basically kicked him out, from what I understand.
Mm.
Which I get. I mean, we don't know what happened. Like, I mean, that's between Freddie and Jim, you know, like, that was their life. I don't know. Maybe they had a falling out, you know, maybe there's issues there. I don't know. But that's kind of what happened. But anyway, because Mary still lives, his mansion, I believe, is called Garden Lodge, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary still lives there. She still lives in Freddie's house. So anyway, after he died, he was cremated. And the story goes that he told Mary, I want where he wanted to be buried. He's like, I want you to take me here, but I don't want anyone to know about it because I don't want anyone digging me up. So Mary, for 2 or 3 years after Freddie died, she just held on to his ashes. And then one day, because again, the paparazzi were still hanging around, like, they're still watching her, right? And there was this one day, I can't remember how she got out of the house, but she got out anyway without being noticed. And apparently that's when she took his ashes and took them wherever that he had requested. And she maintains to this day that she will never reveal where she took Freddie's ashes, because he asked her not to say anything.
Huh. So, well, I mean, that's really nice.
Yeah, definitely a testament to how much they loved each other. Even if, you know, they couldn't be together romantically, you know, they were still there for each other, you know, in every other way, you know, that a loving couple was, you know, or is. And I think they did a good job of portraying that in the movie, you know, like having her be there for him, you know, be the one that brought him back from, you know, his, you know, you know, bad place that he was in, you know, having her be there at Live Aid. And I don't know if she actually was there in real life. I don't think she was. But they, you know, of course they did that for dramatic purposes in the movie. But
I
think it was that it was their way of showing the audience just how much, you know, she was a part of, you know, his life and how important she was. Okay, so I think we can call that an episode because I think I've talked enough. And to be honest, we were going to have my old podcasting pal, Calvin Heighton, who is one of the co-hosts of the Cave of Cool podcast, on for this episode, but unfortunately he couldn't be with us tonight. So I can only imagine just how much longer this episode would have been if Cal had been here. Because Cal,
oh my gosh.
Well, Cal is an original Queen fan. Like, he was there from day one. Like, over at the Cave of Cool podcast, I can't remember what the episode number was, but they did a Bohemian Rhapsody episode shortly after the movie was initially released in theaters, and it was a very good episode, and I highly recommend everyone check that out as well. If you want to listen to more Queen discussion on a podcast, that was a very good episode that him and Michael did. But listening to that episode, like, it's funny because Cal and I podcast...
Episode 5.
Okay, episode 5 of the Cave of Cool podcast. Definitely check that out. Cal and I podcasted for the better part of 3 years, and I don't think we ever talked about Queen. I don't... Like, we never really did a music episode together.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's not... at least in our small circle of podcasting friends... and acquaintances, there aren't a lot of people that do any shows to do with music at all, really. I mean, like, the Purple Stuff podcast occasionally touches on, you know, like wrestling intros and stuff like that. But I mean, like, as far as music, like actual music goes, it's a rare thing for people in our podcasting circle to chat about.
Yeah. And it's just, well, the thing too is, like, I pay attention to what Cal's doing over on his website. Like, on his blog and on his Facebook posts, but I don't ever remember Queen ever coming up until I listened to that episode of The Cave of Cool that they did, and listening to him talk about Queen, it was absolutely amazing. Like, he, like I said, like, he was there back in the 70s when they were first bringing out their records, and he was buying them, and he's been a fan right from day one, so... You know, it's unfortunate due to scheduling conflicts that he couldn't be on tonight, but, you know, I would love to have had him on this episode just for that reason, because he is a fountain of knowledge, and he'd be able to add a lot to this podcast. But,
well, he's a fountain of knowledge about many different subjects.
Oh, yeah. But Queen is definitely, like, one of his, like I said, you got to listen to that episode they did. It was absolutely amazing. Great job. But, I mean, we're already at almost 2.5 hours, going on 3 hours. If we had had Cal on, I guarantee you we would have been pushing the four-hour mark.
Yeah, definitely. It might have been a three-part episode.
Yeah, and it definitely would have been worth it because, you know, like I said, he's so great. But, actually, there's a couple things I wanted to throw out there real quick before we call it an episode. It made me think, because Cal's about the same age as my mom, to be honest with you. He's you know, a bit older than me.
So he's young at heart, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so is my mom. But, like, when we were... It was, I think, the day after, like... Because I said, like, I went to Bohemian Rhapsody with my mom at the theater. And it was, I think, the next day we were driving somewhere. And we were talking about it. And she was telling me a couple things. One, and this is one of the things I want to talk about when Cal was on, because I figured Cal would get a chuckle out of this, because Cal was, you know, again, the same age as my mom, so he, you know, would definitely relate to these stories. When my mom was dating my dad had a truck that had an 8-track machine in it. And one of the 8-track, because I guess my dad only had like two or three actually 8-tracks that he actually owned. And one of them was Killer Queen by Queen. And my mom said every time that she rode with my dad, she'd always play that one because that was her favorite. And then another thing was, because back in the 70s and even 80s and even 90s, really, I grew up in a small community called Fort Assiniboine, which is also where my mom grew up and where we both went to school. So our local radio station, when I say local, I use air quotes, is over 2 hours away from where we lived. It's in Edmonton. So for, you know, when you're listening to a rock station or a music, whatever, to make a request, it was a long distance phone call. And back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, long distance was quite pricey. So apparently what her and her friends used to do, I guess when Bohemian Rhapsody first came on the radio, they loved it. They thought it was fantastic. They wanted to listen to it all the time. So they would go to, at their lunch hour, because they were in high school, so their lunch hour, they would walk to their one friend. Their one friend had an uncle that lived in town, so they would walk to this guy's place, because he was at work, and they would use his phone to call long distance to request Bohemian Rhapsody on the rock station. And she said, you know, like he was the nicest guy because he never got mad at them for racking up the long distance phone bill. Because she said, like, we would go there every day. And then, you know, you call in and then you're, you know, you have to wait. And then, you know, like she said it would have added up, definitely. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Back then, you know, like now we take for granted, like we don't pay long distance. I mean, like right now, you and I are talking for free. You're in Ottawa. I'm almost on the other side of the country. We're talking for free. Doesn't cost us a dime. But, you know, back in the 70s, if you and I were talking like this for 3 hours on the phone.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, our phone bill would be in the hundreds of dollars. Approaching thousands. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, I thought that was kind of a couple of neat things that I learned about my mom. But anyway, we're closing out this episode. Unfortunately, like I said, Cal couldn't be here with us, but he's here in spirit. But Rich, we were talking earlier, which would have been like the first part of this two-part episode, that you have a podcast that you're relaunching. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
I currently do a rehash or a redo of a podcast that you actually helped create called Technobabble, which we have now rebranded as Tech Chatter. And that is the first leg of the new quote unquote network that I'm launching called the Chatter Nexus. And basically that is just me and my buddy Mike chatting about all sorts of gadgets and technology and scientific inventions and discoveries and whatnot. So we do that about give or take once a month, maybe a little more often, maybe a little less. And then I will be launching the second leg of the podcast, hopefully by the end of this month, if all goes well. And that's going to be Pop Chatter, which is going to kind of be my catch-all, where basically I will be going on with it's basically the Richard and Friends show. So it's just nice. Me and anybody that happens to come on. I don't really have a set co-host, although I'm sure Mike will be on the majority of episodes as, you know, he has a fairly open schedule since he basically podcasts for a living. It's pretty much all he does. Nice. So he's kind of the easiest person to get on, but it's just going to be me and a bunch of friends talking about a bunch of different stuff. The first episode, which I've already recorded, is with me and Mike, who also does a popular show called The Graveyard Shift with Mike and Sheldon. Check that out. And we also brought in Eugene from the Epically Geeky show. So that'll be the first episode, and we're looking at what we think Hollywood should do. I think the title is What's Best for Hollywood, and it's basically a look at what we think should be the next big anthology movie or anthology Netflix series or whatever, like the next big, huge, multi-part series that we think Hollywood should be paying attention to. So that will be hitting on iTunes by the end of the month. I've been holding off for a little while because it's on the old Geek Fallout feed and I have yet to transfer everything over. We still have some subscribers that we're trying to get, you know, from that feed over to the Technobabble feed or Tech Chatter feed because we've been using that. So I'll be rebranding that feed completely. And then we also have a third podcast that will be starting hopefully by the end of the month, although it's looking like it'll probably be March, and that's going to be definitely a once a month maximum sort of thing because it's going to be Schlock Chatter, and that's basically going to be me, Mike, and other Ottawa friends basically coming to my place and going down to my party room and watching schlocky movies on a big projector screen and chatting about how terrible they are. Basically, it's kind of a spin-off of Mike's show, The Graveyard Shift, except that instead of focusing on horror movies, we'll be basically just opening it up to all sorts of different movies. The first episode is going to be Iron Sky, which is a independent movie about Nazis on the moon.
Nice.
Yeah, so that'll be the first episode. Hopefully we'll be recording that next week, and then if all goes well, we will be launching that by the end of the month as well. So stay tuned to iTunes or come check us out at facebook.com/chatternexus. And that is CHATR.
Excellent. Excellent. No, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to listening to all them podcasts.
I hope you're looking forward to being on a couple of them as well.
I was going to say that. And we have been talking about a certain, I don't want to reveal what it is, but I've started my notes. It's happening. Now, as far as this podcast is concerned, like I said in our first episode that we released, we said that the next episode was going to be annoying things of pop culture, so that is still coming out. Jason and I are going to be recording that here shortly, so that will be coming out on the feed in the not too distant future. And then I've also all got a couple more episodes recorded. There's one called The State of Star Trek, and then
seriously, you didn't invite? I've binged like 3/4 of all Star Trek that exists in the past month and a half, and you didn't invite me for that? You got to be kidding me.
Well, the thing is, I didn't invite anyone. This was a solo episode.
Okay, and you're lucky. And you're lucky.
Believe it or not, I did a 45-minute solo episode with no breaks. Yeah, I had a lot to get off my chest.
Apparently. Paying attention to some of the Pop Culture Pub Facebook page posts, I'm actually not very surprised that you had a lot to get off your chest about Star Trek.
Yeah, so there's that coming out there. And then there's also, it's actually, I want to call it a companion episode to our Annoying Things in Pop Culture, which I've already recorded, which will be released after the Annoying Things in Pop Culture. Because one of the things I'm going to be talking about on the Annoying Things of Pop Culture episode is social media. And this episode that's going to be a companion to that episode is called Social Media Backlash, and it's about an incident that took place on social media that I was involved with. And
I can't wait to hear that.
It's,
you know, I saw you talk about it on Facebook, and I was very intrigued as to what you were actually talking about, because you didn't actually say anything specific.
Well, so I did do a blog post about it. So if anyone wants to check out that blog post, it is at randomnerdist.blogspot.com. I kind of go into a little bit more detail about what happened. It's funny. I usually don't get into politics. Like I'm not into discussing social issues and stuff like that. But for this, I had to. Like I had, again, it's something I had to get off my chest. So there is that episode coming. And then, yeah, there will be more episodes to come. So on behalf of myself, Chris Lockhart, my co-host, who unfortunately couldn't be here this evening, Mr. Jason Roberts, because unfortunately he hasn't seen Bohemian Rhapsody yet, so...
And on top of that, because I'm stealing him for a couple episodes of my show.
Excellent. No, he's a very versatile guy and very, very, very good person to podcast with. So,
oh, yeah. Super fun guy.
So on behalf of myself and Jason, I want to thank you, dear listener, for taking the time to listen to us. And I want to thank you, Rich, for coming on. This was an awesome discussion, and I really appreciate you being here for this for these episodes.
Oh, a reunion long time coming.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, thank you, Cal. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here, but he's here in spirit. And again, I want to thank you, dear listener, for taking the time to listen to the Pop Culture Pub podcast. I am your host. My name is Chris Lockhart, and we will see you in the not-too-distant future.